room, he wondered who his mystery meeting was with. Dr. Hornig was already seated on one side of the table and was looking over her own handwritten notes. Stansfield took his seat at the head of the table, and Rapp and Kennedy sat across from Hornig. Rapp noticed she was wearing the same clothes as the day before. It appeared as though she had not slept. Taking off her black horn-rimmed glasses, Hornig set them on top of her notes and rubbed her eyes, saying,
"We have a lot of information. An incredible amount, really."
She lowered her hands and shook her head.
"It's going to take months to sort through all of it, but having said that, I know you are more interested in information involving Mr. Aziz and the current White House crisis."
Hornig looked down at her notes.
"I apologize for the lack of summaries and transcripts, but I was working on Mr. Harut right up until I left for this meeting."
"No explanation needed, Dr. Hornig," stated Stansfield.
"To start with," Hornig grabbed a piece of paper, "I have the names of the other 10 terrorists who are with Mr. Aziz at the White House. It was very difficult to get this information out of him."
Hornig handed Stansfield the sheet. The DCI looked at the yellow piece of paper for no more than 5 seconds and then handed the sheet to Irene Kennedy, who studied it with Mitch Rapp looking over her shoulder. Stansfield gave them about 10 seconds and asked,
"Irene?"
Kennedy looked up and brushed a strand of brown hair back behind her ear.
"This will be a big help. Off the top of my head, I know about half of them. I can run the rest through our databanks, and any of the ones that we don't get a profile on, we can ask MI6 or Mossad."
"Good. I want full traces and profiles prepared on each and every one of them as soon as possible."
Stansfield turned back to Hornig.
"Now, what do we know about the demands?"
Hornig looked down at her notes and flipped through several pages.
"Mr. Harut knew in detail about the first demand, involving the return of the frozen assets to Iran. We can infer, since Mitch took him before those demands were made public, that he has intimate knowledge of what Mr. Aziz is going to ask for. Up to a point, that is."
Rapp ignored the first part of Hornig's comment, the part involving the rookie detective work, and asked, "What does up to a point mean?"
"I'll get to that in a minute," replied Hornig. "His second demand involves the lifting of all UN sanctions against Iraq."
Hornig looked at her audience to gauge any reaction and then continued.
"The third demand involves the U.S. recognizing a free and sovereign Palestinian state."
With a furrowed brow, Rapp asked, "Where?" Hornig cleared her throat and said,
"The West Bank and the Gaza Strip."
Rapp set his coffee down. "The Israelis are going to shit their pants."
"I would concur,"
Stansfield looked to Hornig.
"What else?"
"There's one more demand. One final demand. But Mr. Harut doesn't know what it is."
Rapp tilted his head skeptically. "Come again?"
"I really don't think he knows," replied Hornig, a touch defensively. "I spent almost 2 hours delving into this specific subject. I pushed as hard as I felt I could."
"Maybe you need to push harder," stated Rapp. Hornig leaned back slightly and folded her arms.
"I plan on it, just as soon as Mr. Harut gets some rest."
"As soon as you both get some rest," interjected Stansfield. "I don't want you burned out, Dr. Hornig."
Hornig was slightly frustrated by all of the unsolicited advice. She didn't tell them how to do their jobs, and she'd appreciate it if they would return the courtesy. Stansfield, oblivious to Hornig's issues, turned his attention to Kennedy.
"Any thoughts on what the final demand might be?"
Kennedy stared off into space for a moment and then said,
"A few, but I'd like to do a little research before I come to any conclusions."
Looking at one of his most trusted advisors, Stansfield thought of pressing for more information and then decided it was better to let Kennedy develop her theories in time. With some of his people, he had to engage them in a game of mental gymnastics to get the best out of them. With Kennedy, she was best left alone. Stansfield turned his chair back toward Hornig, who was once again shuffling through her notes.
"What else do you have for us, Dr. Hornig?"
Hornig began reading down a long list of information that would be sifted through by agency analysts for months, possibly years to come. Rapp listened intently, gathering more and more insight into how Aziz had put his master plan together. Hornig covered the selection of the men Aziz had brought and where they were trained. She discussed how several of them were sent to America almost a year earlier to start their cover and avoid drawing the attention of the FBI or the Secret Service. She even provided the name of the South American clinic and doctor who had given Aziz his new face. Rapp made a mental note to talk to Kennedy and Stansfield about paying the plastic surgeon a little visit at a later date. The man would live as long as he agreed to cooperate and inform for the agency. A plastic surgeon who kept company with men like Rafik Aziz could be a very valuable informant, if Aziz hadn't already killed him. Hornig was providing a bevy of facts that on their own held no great significance, but as they were pieced together, they would hopefully provide a very valuable map of Aziz's final intent. Hornig shared her information for almost a full 30 minutes. Rapp and Kennedy took notes while Stansfield sat back and listened. As the clock neared 8, Hornig moved on to something she had discovered just before leaving the safe house.
"Early this morning, Mr. Harut kept mentioning a certain name. He was slipping in and out of consciousness and was often incoherent. Despite this state of mind, he kept repeating the word Nebuchadnezzar."
As if on cue, Stansfield, Kennedy, and Rapp all leaned forward. Hornig, looking surprised by the unified reaction, asked,
"You all know what, or I should say who, Nebuchadnezzar was?"
"Was and is," answered Kennedy. "Nebuchadnezzar was the king of Babylonia from 605 to 562 BC. His great claim to fame in the Arab world is that he destroyed Jerusalem in 586 and then enslaved the Israelites. Saddam Hussein fancies himself the second coming of Nebuchadnezzar. He feels that it is his destiny to unite all of the Arab people and destroy Israel."
"He doesn't really believe it," added Rapp with a frown. "He just uses it as a PR ploy to get all of the religious zealots whipped into a frenzy."
"And it works," added Kennedy while leaning forward. "Tell me more about the context in which he mentioned the word."
"I was asking him about the financing for the operation, and again he kept mumbling this word. I looked it up and found out who the historical Nebuchadnezzar was. I had no idea he could have been referring to Saddam Hussein."
"Where was Matt Shipley when all of this was being said?"
Shipley was one of the 200-plus employees who worked for the Counterterrorism Center. His specialty was Arabic languages, and Kennedy had sent him out to the safe house the previous evening to help with the interrogation of Harut. Kennedy didn't show it, but she was irritated that Shipley had missed such an obvious reference.
"I had sent everyone to bed around 5 this morning. We'd been working non-stop since the previous afternoon."
Hornig shrugged her shoulders.
"We needed to give the subject some rest, and I needed to get my notes organized for this meeting. This oversight was not Mr. Shipley's fault."
Kennedy accepted the explanation.
"How did you stumble across this reference if Harut was asleep?"
"I was in the room with him, organizing my notes. Someone has to keep an eye on his vitals, so I was sitting near him when he began to mumble about Nebuchadnezzar. It is not at all unusual for my subjects to continue to talk while they are sleeping."
"Was this recorded?" asked Kennedy.
"Of course. The recording equipment is always running."
"Good."
Kennedy jotted herself a note to call Shipley and tell him to review the tapes immediately.
"What," began Stansfield, "was the general context of his ramblings about Nebuchadnezzar?"
"Money. He kept talking about Nebuchadnezzar and money."
Kennedy finished her note.
"This corroborates what we heard from our other sources, that Saddam was funneling money into Hezbollah and Hamas."
Looking at his watch, Stansfield said,
"Dr. Hornig, do you have anything else for us?"
"No, but I should have more for you this afternoon."
Stansfield looked at Rapp and Kennedy.
"Any other questions?"
"Yeah," said Rapp. "How does Aziz plan on getting out of here when it's all over?" Hornig blinked her eyes as an expression of embarrassment spread across her face.
Ah, I haven't got around to that yet.
Rapp looked at her harshly. You might want to move that one up to the top of your list.
Yes.
Hornig jotted herself a note. Stansfield again looked to Rapp and Kennedy.
Anything else?
They both shook their heads, and then Stansfield looked to the other side of the table.
Nice work so far, Dr. Hornig. Now, if you'll excuse us, I need to discuss a few things with Irene and Mitch.
Hornig gathered her papers and stood. After she'd placed her notes in a tan canvas shopping bag, she left the room. Rapp noticed the canvas bag, and after the door was closed, said, I hope you have somebody babysitting her.
I do,
the director nodded.
But we might want to bring it up a notch.
Stansfield looked to Kennedy.
Irene, I think we need to get some more bodies out there to keep a close eye on things, around the clock. I want somebody from CTC in that room with Harut every second of the day. And I want them awake.
Kennedy shook her head and said, I apologize. I already made a note to take care of it.
Now, Mitch.
Stansfield turned his focus back to Rapp.
Irene and I are heading downtown. Considering how the meeting went at the Pentagon yesterday, I think it would be best if you did not join us.
Rapp had expected this, and in truth he really didn't want to be there to see his predictions come true. There were times when there was no joy in being right, and this would be one of them. What would you like me to do? Retrieving a piece of paper from his shirt pocket, Stansfield unfolded it and slid it across the table.
That is the address and phone number of Milt Adams, the man we discussed with Director Tracy last night. He is expecting your call.
How do you want me to handle it? Stansfield's eyes narrowed while he thought about the question. After several seconds, he said,
Go ahead and use your cover, and tell him you're with Langley. Mr. Adams is a very patriotic individual. We can trust him. But there's no need to tell him anything more than he needs to know.
Stansfield got up, and Kennedy and Rapp followed. As they walked back into the director's office, Stansfield said,
Mitch, it's impossible to overstate how important this is. If you find a way in, General Flood and I will do everything we can to make it happen. Just make sure you give it to me straight. I want realistic odds on whether or not it can be done. Am I understood?
Hiding his excitement, Rapp replied with a simple, Yes, sir. Chapter 15. Rafiq Aziz looked at the computer screen to his left and smiled. They are so predictable, he thought to himself. The laptop computer to his left was hooked up to one of the Situation Room's secure monitors. He was staring at the account balance of the Swiss bank that would receive the money before it was to be safely transferred to Iran. The account was at a little over $1 billion and holding. With about 45 minutes to go, he doubted that they would transfer the remainder of the money. The second laptop to his right was for a special purpose. Every time Aziz looked at it, he beamed with pride. It had been a stroke of genius. Aziz had no doubt that the Americans would come. If he got his hands on the president, his chances might improve, but in the meantime, the second laptop was his fail-safe. Studying American counterterrorism tactics, he understood that above all, they loved their technology. They would try to jam his ability to remotely detonate the bombs, and in the process, they would start a countdown to destruction. Each of the 24 bombs he had brought contained a digital pager that acted as both a receiver and a detonator. Hooked up to the laptop was a digital phone. Every 2 minutes, the computer would dial the group paging number for all 24 bombs and then send a 5-digit number. If that code wasn't received every 2 minutes, the pagers would go into a 60-second countdown mode. If the countdown reached zero, the bombs were ignited. Aziz also carried a pager and a digital phone as a backup measure. If the pager beeped and the countdown was started, it meant only one of two things. Either the Americans were attacking or the computer had malfunctioned. If the computer malfunctioned, he could abort the countdown with his own phone. If that didn't work, it meant the Americans were coming. The Critical Incident Response Group's Crisis Management Unit had set up their command post on the fourth floor of the Executive Office Building in a conference room that overlooked the west wing of the White House. The large wood conference table had been pushed against the inner wall and was covered with a half dozen phones, two radio charger trays, and several laptops. The rest of the room's furniture had been removed, with the exception of about half of the chairs. Against the two side walls, portable tables had been set up and were cluttered with more laptops, phones, televisions, and fax machines. Many of the phones had masking tape on the handsets and were labeled with black felt-tipped marker. Almost half of the phones were dedicated to the FBI's Strategic Information Operations Center, or SIOC. The SIOC, which fell under the purview of the Bureau's Criminal Investigative Division, was charged with handling almost all of the Bureau's high-profile cases. Maps of the White House compound and blueprints of the inner structure were pasted to the walls, and men and women in blue FBI polo shirts were busy pecking away at computers and talking into phones. Two negotiators who were fluent in Arabic were on site and ready to man the phones for as long as the siege lasted. Special Agent Skip McMahon stood at the window and glared at the spectacle taking place in Lafayette Square across the street from the White House. He was fuming. Actually, pissed was the word he had been using repeatedly since around 5 a.m. Within hours of the terrorist attack on the White House, the media had moved in and set up shop smack dab in the middle of Pennsylvania Avenue. They began broadcasting their live reports from right in front of the White House's north fence. When McMahon had arrived on the scene, one of his first orders was to have the media moved back, way back. Hours earlier, in the pre-dawn darkness, McMahon had been attempting to steal some sleep on the couch in his office at the Hoover Building when one of his agents came in to inform him that a federal judge had intervened on behalf of the networks. Now, as McMahon looked down on Lafayette Square, the media circus was omnipresent. On the north end of the park, a mere 100 yards from the White House, the three networks and CNN were all broadcasting live from atop elevated platforms, and Fox was scrambling to join the group. They were all there with their morning shows as if it were a goddamn state fair. Good Morning America, Today, CBS This Morning, all of them. For the last 2 hours, McMahon had been fighting the urge to pick up the phone and start chewing ass about the judge's ruling. He had instead decided it was a better use of his time and energy to wait until all of the big shots were together. McMahon looked at his watch. It was 8:34, and they should be arriving any minute. She had made it through the first 24 hours without getting hit. Anna really felt pretty good, considering what she had been through. Her back was a little stiff from sleeping on the floor, or at least trying to sleep on the floor. The terrorists had made sleep next to impossible by waking them at least once an hour from sundown to sunup. And to make matters worse, they also pulled people from the group and beat them in front of everyone. For the women, there was something else to be afraid of. Sometime after midnight, a young blonde woman had been yanked from the group by the terrorist that had followed Reilly into the bathroom. Reilly could not say for sure how long the young woman had been gone. The terrorists had taken everyone's watch in an effort to further disorient them, but it seemed to be at least several hours. When the woman finally returned, her clothes were partially torn, and she had a look in her eyes, a look Reilly had once seen in her own eyes. Reilly glanced down at Stone Alexander, who was lying crunched up in a fetal position, his jacket neatly folded under his head for a pillow. She was grateful that he had stopped crying. The less attention drawn to them, the better. Brushing a wisp of hair back behind her ear, she looked around the room, careful to keep her head down. Two guards were by the door, talking to each other. Reilly knew she wasn't the only one who had to go to the bathroom, but no one dared ask after what had happened the night before. Folding her legs Indian style, she glanced over her shoulder and then quickly turned her head back. The terrorist, the one with all of the jewelry and slicked back hair, was staring at her with a cigarette hanging from his mouth, the same man who had plucked the young blonde from the group the night before. Anna Reilly had been through that nightmare before, and she had sworn to herself that she would rather die than let it happen again. 4 years earlier, Reilly had taken the loop from the TV station in downtown Chicago to her apartment in Lincoln Park. It was late when she stepped off the train. When she reached the street, two men jumped her from the shadows and dragged her into an alley and raped her. That harrowing event had left her bruised and battered, but her physical wounds were easy to overcome compared to the deeper mental scars. Even these were starting to heal, though, thanks in no small part to Corrine Alton, Reilly's therapist. Reilly had been going to Alton twice a week for almost 4 years. Before the rape, she had been a fun-loving, outgoing young woman who very much enjoyed male companionship. The rape had given her a hard edge and an understandable distrust of men. With the help of Alton, she had again grown to enjoy the company of men who were interested in her, but the physical boundary still had not been crossed. When she took her new job in Washington, Reilly thought it was the perfect chance for a fresh start. One of the only benefits of the personal disaster was her hyper-awareness. Reilly had already had street smarts, but the rape had raised her awareness to an almost paranormal level. It was hard to imagine how her current situation could get any worse, but Reilly sensed that when nightfall came, it would. Irene Kennedy was almost run over as she attempted to enter the FBI's command post. Two stocky men in SWAT uniforms came barreling out the doorway. The first almost butted Kennedy in the forehead with the brim of his blue baseball cap, but stopped just shy, grabbing her by the shoulders. He apologized without realizing whom he had almost knocked down, and then recognized Kennedy.
"Oh, Irene, I'm sorry."
Sid Slater, a.k.a. the Jewish Terror, was still holding her by the shoulders. "Sid?" said Kennedy, also surprised, not used to seeing the commander of the FBI's hostage rescue team in full SWAT gear. Slater had the physique of a bricklayer. Several inches shy of 6 feet and in his mid-40s, he had a barrel chest and strong, thick hands attached to Popeye-like forearms. Slater wasn't built to run marathons. Rather, he was more suited to run through bolted doors. "Where are you off to in such a hurry?" asked Kennedy.
"I'm trying to get some last-minute intel before they start talking."
Slater pointed with his thumb over his shoulder and shook his head.
"And I sure as hell don't want to be in there when the shit hits the fan."
Kennedy looked into the room. "What's going on?"
"I don't have time to talk about it. Skip can fill you in. Are you going to be in the planning meeting this afternoon?"
Kennedy nodded.
"I'll be there." "Good. We can talk then. I have a lot of questions for you."
With that, the Jewish Terror headed off down the hallway. As Slater and the other man marched away, Kennedy watched them for a second, the bright yellow letters on their backs and their dark SWAT uniforms announcing to all that they were on the front line, that they would be the ones to storm the White House. Kennedy considered all the explosives Aziz had brought along and felt overwhelming dread as Slater moved off. Kennedy entered the FBI's command post, which was buzzing with the activity of radios, phones, faxes, and people. She had just left the conference room on the other side of the building, where Vice President Baxter was gathered with select members of the cabinet and the intelligence and federal law enforcement communities. From there, that group would monitor the conversations between Aziz and the FBI negotiator and make any decisions if needed. At McMahon's request, Kennedy was to stay with him at the FBI's command post to offer any insight. Across the room by the windows that overlooked the West Wing, Skip McMahon was talking to a seated Attorney General Tutwiler and motioning to a group of phones. Kennedy walked across the room and stopped several feet away so as to not interrupt. She listened to what Skip was saying and quickly grew alarmed. Kennedy began to look around the room, and she did not like what she saw or didn't see. It was getting close to 9, and she did not see anyone who appeared to be the FBI negotiator. A short while later, McMahon finished explaining to Tutwiler how the different phones worked and then turned to face Kennedy. With his back to the Attorney General, he rolled his eyes in frustration.
"Morning, Irene."
"Good morning." Kennedy nodded to Tutwiler and then looked back at McMahon. "Where is your negotiator?" Before McMahon had a chance to answer, Tutwiler said, "I'll be handling the negotiations." In as passive a tone as Kennedy could muster, she replied, "No offense, Madam Attorney General, but I don't think that is the most prudent course."
"And why is that?" asked Tutwiler aggressively.
"Because Rafiq Aziz will take it as an insult that we have chosen a woman to negotiate with him."
"I am here, Ms. Kennedy, because I am the top-ranking law enforcement officer in the land. I am here," Tutwiler stressed the word and pointed at the ground, "to send a clear message to these terrorists that we are extremely serious about this situation."
Kennedy's thoughts drifted back to Mitch Rapp's words at the Pentagon the day before. They gave her the strength to state her opinion a bit more firmly.
"And I am here to advise you, as the director of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center, you are making a grave mistake. I respect your accomplishments, Madam Attorney General, but Rafiq Aziz will not. He will make you pay for what he will see as a blatant insult to his manhood."
Tutwiler defiantly crossed her arms.
"I have encountered chauvinists all my life, and I have found that there is only one way to deal with them, head on."
"Again, I respect your accomplishments, but you couldn't be more wrong. You have absolutely no idea who you're dealing with."
Seeing that Tutwiler was not going to budge, Kennedy left the room and started down the hallway to explain the new development to Stansfield. Midway down the hall, she heard McMahon call her name. A second later, McMahon pulled up alongside her and placed his hand on her shoulder.
"Irene, it's not worth it. I already went all the way to the top. For now, she gets her way."
Kennedy stopped, her cheeks slightly flushed. Murmuring more to herself than McMahon, she said,
"Now I know why Mitch got so mad yesterday."
McMahon didn't quite get Kennedy's comment and decided to ignore it.
"The way I figure it, Irene, is that Tutwiler's ass is hanging out pretty far on this one. After she screws up this morning, she'll be out of our hair."
McMahon studied Kennedy's tense face, not used to such a reaction from the almost always unflappable protege of Thomas Stansfield.
"Take a deep breath, Irene. It's not going to do you any good to get upset right now."
Kennedy looked up at McMahon and bit down on the bottom corner of her lip.
"I'm usually the one giving you this lecture."
"What can I say? I'm a quick learner."
McMahon gave her a fake smile and turned Kennedy back toward the command post.
"I need you with me during this call, all right?"
Kennedy nodded and went along reluctantly. His fingers tapped the shiny surface of the conference table of the White House Situation Room, and his eyes stayed transfixed on the computer screen. Rafiq Aziz sat in the president's leather chair, rocking slightly. Aziz brought his wrist up and checked the time. The balance of the Swiss bank account hadn't changed in almost half an hour. 2 more minutes, and the spectacle would start. Aziz's eyes lifted an inch above the top of the computer screen and looked at the bank of television screens that dominated the far wall. The 3 major networks and CNN were all broadcasting live from the other side of Lafayette Park. NBC and CBS were interviewing family members of the hostages. ABC was talking to a psychiatrist who had written a book on hostages identifying with their captors, the so-called Stockholm Syndrome, and CNN was talking to a retired FBI agent, whom Aziz thought to be typically smug. A thin smile creased his lips as Aziz thought about just how predictable these Americans were. The smile widened even further. Aziz put his hands behind his neck and rocked back and forth in the chair. A mailbox icon appeared on the second laptop, and an electronic voice alerted him to an incoming email. Aziz quickly tapped the proper keys, and a second later, the message was up on the screen. As Aziz read the message, he moved closer to the screen, reading the first line over and over, unable to get past the shock of it.
It couldn't be. How could they have gotten their hands on him? Why now?
The message read, Farah Harut abducted in early morning commando raid yesterday. Group suffered heavy casualties. Harut assumed taken alive. Do not know who conducted operation, but assume either America, Britain, or Israel. Across the street in the executive office building, Vice President Baxter was holding court in a separate conference room down the hall from the FBI's command post. As always, Dallas King was sitting next to Baxter, General Flood was on the Vice President's left, and farther down the table, FBI Director Roach, CIA Director Stansfield, and Secret Service Director Tracy had taken their seats. The Secretary of State and Defense were also present, along with a dozen aides and several Secret Service agents from the Vice President's detail. The door was closed, and each occupant stared expectantly at the black speaker placed in the center of the table. After 20 more seconds of silence, the black box announced the ringing of the phone in the Situation Room. Aziz was still staring at the message when the phone started to ring. He was furious, outraged that such a thing could happen, and now of all times. His eyes burned a hole in the screen as his mind raced to calculate the potential damage this catastrophe could inflict on his mission. All the while, Aziz tried to keep emotion out of it. Farah Harut was his mentor, the man who had wooed him from the classroom to the battlefield, the man who had shown him the evil of the Zionists. Harut was the reason he was where he was today, and now he was gone. The phone continued its irritating noise, and Aziz had to catch himself from answering it. Not now. Not until he calmed down and put himself in the proper mindset. There was the plan, and he had to stick with it. After he had more time to think, he could deal with this calamity. Laying his hands flat on the table, he forced all the tension from his body and immersed himself in his role. Finally, after the phone had rung at least a dozen times, he reached out and slowly brought the receiver to his mouth.
"Yes."
"Mr. Aziz," stated a calm and confident female voice. "This is Attorney General Margaret Tutwiler. We are having some problems getting together all of the money."
There was a pause on the line, and then,
"So far we have managed to transfer
$1.3 billion. Aziz gave her the sum as he stood abruptly, anger coursing through every inch of his body. This was too much. He had done his research on the Americans. He knew who all of the players would be. He knew that with Hayes out of commission, the transfer of power would take place, and with Vice President Baxter came an increased role for the already important Attorney General. But to insult him in such a way was inconceivable. It was such a blatant affront that there was no way it could be anything other than intentional." A slightly surprised Tutwiler said,
"Yes, $1.3 billion."
She stammered for a second.
"It's going to take some time to gather all of the money. It would be a big help as far as expediting the transfer of the remainder of the money if you could show us a sign of your good faith."
Aziz closed his eyelids tightly, commanding himself to continue forward with the plan. In a pained voice, he asked,
"What would you propose?" "The release of several hostages would go a long way in showing us you are sincere."
This was beyond belief. In a voice that was near breaking, Aziz asked,
"How many would you like me to release? 10? 20? Maybe 30 of them?"
Tutwiler, unsure of how genuine the offer was, tentatively replied,
30 would be great, and after they are released, we can work on getting more of the money transferred."
Aziz stood looking down the length of the table, staring at everything and nothing at the same time, his instincts sharp, his anger funneling into a direct beam of energy. Plan or no plan, this had moved into the realm of the personal. They were trying to insult him by sending this woman to talk with him. They were testing him to see how far he would go. Was it a trap? He thought not. It was too early for an attack. It was broad daylight, and the media was right across the street. If they wanted to test his resolve, he would show them just how strong and determined it was. It was all too much. First the news that Farah Harut had been taken, and now this stupid woman insulting him. Finally, unable to hold it in any more, he yelled, "What did I tell you yesterday? I said all of the money by 9. I didn't say part of it. I said all of it. Don't insult me by talking to me of the difficulty of transferring the money. Your treasury department could transfer 10 times the money I asked for in 1 hour if they wanted to. I think it is time to teach you stupid Americans a lesson. Look out your windows, and I will show you what happens when you play your idiotic games with me." Anna Reilly sat on the floor uncomfortably, her stomach growling. She seriously wondered if she'd be able to make it another hour without wetting her pants. Several of the other hostages had already done so, and the room was beginning to reek of urine. Reilly heard the sound of heavy boots approaching, and then the head terrorist entered the room. The entire group cowered at the sight of the obviously enraged man. Aziz walked right up to the edge of the hostages and pointed to a man.
"You, stand up right now!"
Whoever he was yelling at didn't respond fast enough, and Aziz yelled even louder,
"Now!"
As the hostage stood, Reilly immediately recognized him. It was Bill Schwartz, the president's national security advisor. The terrorist screamed at the woman who was clutching Schwartz's leg and said,
"You too, come!"
The woman also did not move fast enough, and Aziz reached down and grabbed her by her hair, yanking her to her feet like a rag doll. With the help of another terrorist, he led them out of the room. Aziz pushed the two hostages in front of him up the stairs to the first level of the West Wing. Then, before stepping out underneath the small portico on the north side of the building, Aziz pulled a mesh hood down over his face. He took a small remote control from his drab green combat vest and punched in a code, disarming the explosive device that was attached to the door. Aziz kicked open the double doors and marched outside. All alone in the morning sunlight, he crossed the narrow driveway and stepped back onto another sidewalk near the edge of the small portico. Aziz defiantly looked around at the dozens of guns that were trained on him. The long barrels of sniper rifles could be seen bristling from every rooftop in America. He knew they wouldn't shoot. They couldn't shoot, not in America. That command had to come down through layers of bureaucrats, and it was far too early for that. Aziz raised his AK-74 in the air and unleashed a loud 8-round burst. Defiantly, he cradled his weapon across his chest and stood his ground, showing the Americans that he was not afraid. After he had made his presence felt, he marched back into the building and looked at his watch. He had decided he would give the media 30 seconds to get their cameras focused on the entrance. Aziz was following his script precisely, with one exception: the rage. It had been his plan from the start to kill the National Security Advisor, but now he decided to deviate slightly from the plan and allow himself some personal satisfaction in retaliation for Harut. In an almost spastic fury, Aziz wheeled and slapped Schwartz across the face. His face within inches of Schwartz's, he yelled,
"How does it feel to be terrified, you dog?"
The National Security Advisor's eyes welled up with tears, and the woman standing next to him began to sob. Schwartz wrapped his arms around his secretary. He knew what was happening. He knew it was the end, and there was nothing he could do to stop it. Aziz continued to scream and taunt him with questions.
"How many times have you ordered the death of my Arab brothers? How many times?"
Aziz's eyes were maniacal with rage. Schwartz gave no answer, and Aziz slapped him again. Then, grabbing him by the collar, Aziz forced the National Security Advisor toward the door with his secretary's arm still wrapped tightly around her boss's waist. As they reached the door, Aziz placed his boot on the woman's butt and shoved. Schwartz and the woman tumbled out into the light and fell to the pavement. Aziz stood in the doorway and yelled through his mesh hood for them to get up.
The woman was crying harder now, and Schwartz's tears were flowing freely down his cheeks. The presidential advisor stood and pulled his secretary to her feet. Aziz screamed at them to start walking, and after several seconds they began to do so, though slowly. Standing in the doorway, Aziz watched the two hostages walk toward the north gate. When they reached the halfway point, when they were within clear view of the news cameras, Aziz raised his rifle and took aim.
"Stop!" he yelled.
When the president's national security advisor turned to look over his shoulder, Aziz had Schwartz's face in the center of his sights. He squeezed the trigger once, the powerful rifle bucked, and he brought it right back to level, the woman's head now framed in the cold black sights. A quick squeeze of the trigger and the second body was tumbling to the pavement just behind the first. As the woman came to rest on top of Schwartz, Aziz zeroed in and unloaded another dozen rounds. The loud clacking of the Kalashnikov rifle reverberated across the pristine north grounds of the White House. When Aziz was satisfied, he closed the door, the smoking muzzle of his AK-74 hanging at his side. Before starting back for the basement, he rearmed the booby-trapped doorway and then started down the hall, his eyes full of hate, his breaths deep, and his pace quick. When he reached the staircase, he ran down the steps, through the hallway, and into the empty situation room. Grabbing the phone, he yelled,
"Are you still there?"
Skip McMahon held the phone to his ear and looked down at the two bodies lying in the driveway. The man he recognized. He then turned to Marge Tutwiler, who sat motionless at the table, staring out the window. McMahon then looked at Irene Kennedy, who sadly shook her head.
"I'm here," answered McMahon.
"Who is this?" shouted Aziz.
"Special Agent Skip McMahon of the FBI."
"Good. Don't ever insult me by putting that woman on the phone again. My demands are unchanged. I will kill one hostage every hour until all of the money is placed in the account I have given you. When you do that, I will release one-third of the hostages. One hostage every hour. Am I understood?"
"I understand you very clearly, but 1 hour might be pushing it."
Now was the time to shift gears.
"Listen to me, McMahon."
Aziz now spoke calmly, in an almost professional tone.
"I know your rules of engagement. I just killed two hostages, so now you must send in your hostage rescue team."
Aziz stopped and then added in a grave tone,
"That will be a big mistake, and I will tell you why. If you attempt such a stunt, I will blow this great building of yours to kingdom come and all of the hostages with it. My men and I will gladly become martyrs for our cause, and you know it."
Aziz paused for a moment.
"It does not need to come to that, however. The only reason I killed those two hostages was because of the stupidity of your attorney general. If you and I play by the rules, no one needs to die. You hand over all of the money in 1 hour, and I release a third of the hostages. It is as simple as that. Have I made myself clear?"
"Yes."
"Good. From now on, McMahon, I talk to you and only you. Now, I will wait for the rest of the money."
Aziz calmly placed the phone back in its cradle. He knew exactly how to play them. Chapter 16. The vice president and the others sat in silence around the conference table. There was a knock on the door, followed by a slight pause. Then the door opened cautiously, and McMahon and Irene Kennedy entered. The men sitting around the table were sullen. FBI Director Roach looked up and asked,
"Who did they kill?"
Irene Kennedy answered, "We don't know who the woman was, but the man was Bill Schwartz." Every person in the room lowered his or her head. They had all worked with Schwartz at one time or another, and he was well-liked. After a long period of silence, Vice President Baxter asked,
"If we give him the money, will he release a third of the hostages?"
The question was greeted with shrugs and uncertainty by all of the men sitting at the table. Eventually, all eyes turned to Kennedy. She was the expert. Slowly, she nodded her head and then said, "I think he will keep his word." The vice president took in the analysis with pursed lips. It was what he wanted to hear. Dallas King leaned over and cupped his hand over his boss's ear. Whispering, he said, "If he starts killing a hostage every hour, we are in some serious trouble. I don't care how much it costs or what they do with the money. If we can free a third of the hostages, I say we do it." Baxter nodded as King eased away and back into his seat. King was right. They were boxed in, and there were only two ways out. As far as Baxter was concerned, one of them wasn't even an option. The vice president looked at FBI Director Roach and said, "Brian, would you start the wheels in motion for transferring the rest of the money into the account? It is my decision that we will wait until he releases one-third of the hostages, and then we will proceed from there. Any questions?" Baxter looked around the room and everyone shook their heads. Baxter then looked back to the head of the FBI. "Let me know if you run into any problems, and make sure it's done within the hour. We don't need to see any more hostages gunned down." Roach nodded, and he and McMahon left the room. The aged director of Central Intelligence sat in his chair and observed. He hadn't had a lot of face time with the vice president prior to the crisis, and was still trying to get a good read on him. Baxter seemed to despise the fact that he had been put in this situation. That worried Thomas Stansfield. Great leaders rose to the occasion. They almost thrived when confronted with a crisis. This man seemed to shrink from it. Turning in his chair, Stansfield got back to the business at hand.
"Mr. Vice President, we need to make some contingency plans."
Baxter nodded.
I know, but let's just take it one step at a time. Let's get some of the hostages released, and then we'll deal with the next demand."
"I'm afraid we don't have that luxury, sir."
Stansfield paused.
"What if his next demand is untenable?"
Stansfield had decided to wait until he had a full report from Dr. Hornig before he briefed the vice president on what they knew from Harut.
"I really don't want to think about that right now."
General Flood leaned forward, miffed at Baxter's reply.
"We have no choice but to think about it. We have to be ready to move if this thing gets out of control."
Baxter squirmed. All eyes in the room were on him, and he desperately wanted to avoid making a decision. Why would he have to be the butcher? Finally, reluctantly, he let out the difficult words, though they didn't exactly ring with confidence.
"Get everything in place, and if the time comes, I'll be ready to give the order."
The large warrior turned to Stansfield, and the two men exchanged knowing glances. Baxter did not have what it would take. He was in over his head, and would blow in the wind until the last possible second. The vice president placed his elbows on the table and rubbed his eyes. Without looking up, he said,
"Let's take a break and meet back here in 30 minutes. I need some time alone to think."
Everyone, with the exception of King, rose and started for the door. Baxter looked at his chief of staff and said,
"You too, Dallas. Go check on Marge and see how she's doing."
King nodded and left with the others. It had been an absolute bear to get from Langley to Capitol Hill. Traffic was horrendous due to the street closures and the large crowds around the White House. Rapp turned his black Volvo from 2nd Street onto Pennsylvania Avenue and gunned it to get around a cabbie who was driving like he had his head shoved up his ass. The farther Rapp traveled away from the Capitol, the worse the neighborhood got. The mix of homes went from nicely restored to run-down and dilapidated eyesores. Several blocks later, Rapp took a left and found the home he had been looking for, an immaculate turn-of-the-century Victorian with fresh paint and ornate woodwork. The home was sandwiched in between two rotting houses of similar architecture that were in dire need of repair. Rapp parked his car in front of the nice Victorian and looked at his dashboard clock. 9:16. Events at the White House would be underway. He reached for his digital phone, but decided against it. Irene would have enough going on. She didn't need a call from him, and besides, he wasn't in the mood for bad news. Rapp got out of the car, his holstered Beretta bulging underneath the right armpit of his suit coat. He pulled his sunglasses down a notch on his nose and started up the sidewalk. Standing on the porch was Milt Adams, all 5 feet 5 inches of him. His head was shaved, and his dark black skin glistened in the sunlight. Despite his slight stature, he gave one the impression of a much larger individual. As Rapp reached the steps, a rather large German shepherd was coming down from the porch straight for him. Rapp tensed at his natural urge to pull out his gun and shoot the dog. He hated dogs. Strike that, he didn't hate dogs per se, just the guard dog variety. They were an occupational hazard that he was none too fond of. Knowing that to show fear was suicidal, Rapp stood stiff as a board with his hands at his sides. Sure enough, the dog came right up and stuck its snout in his crotch. Rapp's immediate reaction was to take a step back, but it did no good. The dog simply followed, sniffing loudly. From the porch, Milt Adams shouted in a deep drill instructor voice, "Rufus, heel!" The dog immediately wheeled and headed up the steps, heeding the command and taking up a post at his owner's side. Adams reached down and scratched the dog under the neck.
"Good boy, Rufus, good boy."
Rapp stared up at Adams, awed that such a deep, booming voice had just come from such a little body. Adams could not have weighed more than 150 pounds, and the voice Rapp had just heard could have given James Earl Jones, Isaac Hayes, and Barry White all a run for their money.
"Are you Mr. Cruz?" asked Adams.
"Yes," Rapp walked up the first two steps and stuck out his hand. "You must be Milt Adams."
"That's correct. It's nice to meet you."
"Likewise." Adams motioned for Rapp.
"Follow me. I've got everything set up inside."
The two men walked into the house, the dog following at Rapp's side. Adams continued straight ahead down a long hallway to the rear of the house and the kitchen. The hardwood floors had been recently redone with a shiny coat of polyurethane, and the kitchen floor was tiled in a classic black and white checkerboard pattern. The trim was all restored to its natural wood finish with a light stain. Adams opened a glass-paned cupboard and grabbed two mugs.
"You look like the black type."
"That'd be great." The German shepherd parked his butt right next to Rapp and leaned his head against Rapp's thigh. The proximity of the canine made Rapp increasingly uncomfortable. Adams finished pouring the coffee and turned around. He took one look at Rapp's stiff posture and said,
"You don't like dogs."
It was more a statement than a question.
Not
really. Adams handed him a cup.
"What's the problem? You've been bit before?"
"Several times." Rapp winced as he thought of one time in particular. Adams surveyed his guest. The longer hair and facial scar made him begin to wonder if this man really worked for the Secret Service.
"Don't worry," Adams offered. "As long as you don't hurt me, Rufus won't hurt you."
The owner of the house started across the room.
"Let's go down to the basement. That's where I have everything."
Rapp watched Adams cross the kitchen and followed. The damn dog would not leave his side. Rapp was impressed with Adams, who hustled down the steep steps like a man half his age. When Rapp reached the basement, he stopped and looked around the large room. It was a retired man's wet dream. The floor was painted a spotless gray and looked clean enough to eat off. Tools of every kind hung from brown pegboard along one wall, and each spot was labeled to ensure optimal organization. Along the far wall, 6 metal storage cabinets were lined up, each of them again labeled with a laminated catalog of the items within. 2 drafting tables and a computer dominated the wall to the right. In the center of the room, several white sheets covered something roughly the size of a pool table. Cocking his head sideways, Rapp tried to sneak a peek under the sheets, but couldn't see anything. The wiry Adams stopped at the drafting table on the left and turned on a bright overhead lamp. He motioned down at the 3x4-foot blueprint on the table.
This is an overview of the White House and its grounds. Director Tracy tells me you're interested in finding a way to get into the mansion unnoticed.
Rapp nodded. Adams looked up questioningly, as if studying Rapp. After a moment, he said,
Something tells me you're not Secret Service, Mr. Cruz.
Please call me Mitch, and no, I don't work for the Secret Service.
Okay, Mitch. Who do you work for?
I'm an analyst for the CIA. A wry smile creased Adams's lips. In his deep voice, he replied,
Analyst my ass.
Rolling up his left sleeve, Adams revealed a thick, worm-like scar that sliced from his elbow almost down to his wrist. Holding it up for Rapp to see, he said,
Got this on Iwo Jima, bayoneted by some crazy Jap.
Adams pointed to Rapp's face.
You've got a nice thin scar there. Can't even see it unless you're looking at you from the side. You've had some nice plastic surgery done on it, but my guess is it used to be a big ugly thing like this one here on my arm.
Adams studied him again.
You didn't get it from analyzing satellite imagery, did you?
Rapp played it cool, asking, How'd you know I had plastic surgery?
My oldest daughter is a doctor over at GW. I can see the work of a talented surgeon, so let's cut the shit. What do you really do for Langley?
Rapp looked at Adams deliberately. He liked his cut-to-the-heart-of-the-matter style and decided the old man was a little too wily to play games with. So Rapp decided to give it to him as straight as he could. I can't get into the details, but I'm more than a paper pusher.
Is Cruz your real name?
Rapp shook his head. Adams eyed him suspiciously and then shrugged his shoulders.
Well, I'll have to trust Director Tracy. If he says I should give you the information, I'll give it to you.
Adams turned his attention back to the blueprint and ran his finger over it, tracing a line.
There is one way to get into the White House below ground.
Adams flipped up the first blueprint and revealed another one.
It's the most well-known, the tunnel that comes over from the Treasury Building.
Adams stabbed his finger on the right side of the blueprint and drew a line showing Rapp where the tunnel was.
This is the tunnel that the terrorists used.
That's it? Asked Rapp, surprised. There's only one tunnel? Adams nodded.
There's only one tunnel. All the BS Hollywood puts out has most people thinking there's a dozen secret tunnels heading in every different direction.
Adams shook his head.
Not true.
Disappointed, Rapp said, So there's no other way in below ground.
I didn't say that.
Adams held up a finger and smiled. He then stepped over to the other drafting table.
During the Reagan administration, the Army Corps of Engineers installed a new heating, ventilation, and cooling system. This HVAC they installed was really impressive stuff, very high-tech. Besides providing all of the basic heating and cooling requirements, the system is designed to keep the air pressure inside the White House higher than the air pressure outside.
Why? Asked Rapp.
Maintaining a higher internal pressure ensures that all airflow, either through open doors, windows, or cracks, will always flow out instead of in. This way, if anyone tries to introduce a biological or chemical weapon into the building's environment, they couldn't do it by simply releasing the toxin upwind from the building. They would have to get inside the building and release it, and even if they did, the system is equipped with alarms and filters.
Rapp thought he saw where Adams was going and asked, Where does the system get its air?
The system has two sets of intake and exhaust ducts. The first is located on the roof of the White House, and the second is located here.
Adams pointed to an area on the south lawn.
The duct is hidden under a clump of fake bushes, not more than 15 yards from the fence on the east side, just south of Jackie Kennedy's Rose Garden. The duct drops 30 feet straight down and then runs for a little over 200 feet, where it connects with the main system in the engineering room of the third basement.
Rapp looked at the drawing. What kind of cover is there around this duct? Could you get to it without someone from the roof seeing you?
There's plenty of cover.
Come over here and I'll show you on the model.
Adams walked over to the middle of the room and proudly pulled two white sheets off the large table. Lying before them on the table was a detailed model of the White House and its grounds.
This is what retirement does to you, Mitch. I started this project almost 20 years ago with one of my nephews. It took me almost all of that time to get half of it finished. And then I retired and finished the rest of it in 6 months.
Rapp stared at the model and searched for the duct in question. Reading his mind, Adams reached down and moved a small bush.